Thanks. Well, great to be here. Great that there is such a thing, and so many of you have come to it. In all my talks, I'm going to be talking about the great opportunities I see for Christians in our contemporary setting. Christians who may end up being about the only people who end up using their minds and knowing how to think and being able to think clearly. So it's a great encouragement to me and those that I've talked to just a little while I'm here. I am very, very, very pumped up about this. You know, the 20th century is just about over. I remember when I was growing up, I was in the 50s and the early 60s, calculating the days. How old will I be when it gets to be the year 2000? I was watching the Disney Tomorrowland and the Jetsons and all the visions of what the year 2000 would be, and figuring, well, I might make it. I seem pretty old, but I thought I might stay alive, and I may yet, if I can hang in there. But the 20th century was such a period. It's interesting when you look at 100 years ago in 1898, what people were thinking about the 20th century, about the new modern world that was opening up. There was such optimism. And through the whole 20th century, it was an age of modern thought and modern art and modern architecture and modern theology, and it was thought that the modern age was something really different and advanced. The modern battle cry swept away the past and all of these old ideas. They've got to be modern. Well, the interesting thing is now all of the optimism and things that people thought of with the 20th century, the 20th century is gone for all practical purposes. And the worldview that dominated the 20th century, that's fading also. On every level, art, architecture, philosophy, theology, you name it. The modern era is over. And now we're moving into what people are calling the postmodern. In other words, what's after the modern? In other words, what are we facing right now? What is the new worldview? What are the worldviews that are going to be an issue in the next century? They're already taking hold. So that's what I want to talk about right now. But maybe the best way to start is to look at these, we'll use those terms. There's the modern, there's the pre-modern. So we'll look at pre-modern, modern, and then post-modern, what we're coming into right now. In the pre-modern era, pretty much everything up until the 1700s, of course it survived different places. And today, but in the pre-modern era, there was a range of truth. People agreed that the objective world was real. Great strides in natural sciences. That's one kind of thing we can know, truth about the objective world. There are other kinds of truth, though. That's not the only kind. Intellectual truth. By thinking, by using reason, by using logic, you can come to some truth. Morality is a matter of truth. That's an objective fact. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not kill. That moral statements have the status of truth. And certainly there are revealed truths. You know, what can we know about God? Well, many of the old theologians said that we can maybe figure out by reason that there is a God. We can't really know much about Him. We can't know someone who's beyond our creation itself, since He made everything there is. The only way we can really know how God is to us what he thinks about us, who he is in his person, is through his revelation, through his language. And so reveal truth, the truth of Scripture, or another category of truth. So just about everyone before the 1700s thought in those ways, even non-Christians. Even non-Christians would recognize the range of truth that's there. What happened, though, with the Enlightenment of the 1700s is a narrowing of what's considered truth. The era of the Enlightenment, the so-called Age of Reason, said, no, only what our human mind can understand logically, that's the only kind of truth we should consider. Okay, of course, they threw out revealed truth. They still kept moral truth, because you can reason about that in a way. But you see a narrowing through the 19th century with the just booming of science, with Darwin, and the philosophy of materialism. They narrowed it another step in that same direction, that the only thing that's true is what we can see, what we can empirically observe. But for anything that happens in this closed natural system, there has to be a natural cause for it. And so truth is narrowed even more. So modernism, many people say, really began with the Enlightenment, but it really kept building and building and became really dominant in the 20th century. And modernism had beliefs like this. Again, only what is material is real. Therefore, only what you can see and measure can have the status of knowledge or of truth. So you have a great trust in science. Even among people who didn't understand science, we trusted it. We were just confident that science would solve all of our problems. Couple this with a belief in progress, which again comes out of an application of Darwin, that things are really getting better and better and better. And that now that we're in the modern age, now that we're in the 20th century, we can throw out all those old superstitious ideas that we had in the past. And let science get going, and we can build the perfect society. This is an age of a lot of kind of human-centered ideologies. Social engineering, the idea that we can solve poverty, we can solve the problem of poverty, if we just put enough experts into the problem and set up enough government programs. Hey, we'll defeat poverty for the first time ever. Ideologies such as Marxism, which you've been you're studying, again a dialectical materialist based on conflict, almost a Darwinian class conflict that will lead to ultimate social progress and a perfect society. A whole range of things. And people who didn't go that far just believe that things were getting better. And again, that science and technology is the key. And being modern is the key. If we get rid of all these outmoded ideas, we'll be progressing. In morality, for example, it isn't that they threw out morality completely, but they approached morality in terms of what you can see, in terms of what's observable. The whole philosophy, moral philosophy of utilitarianism. In other words, if something is useful, if something helps the society, then it's good. You see, the problems of that, you know, what do you mean by help? You know, you can't avoid transcendent judgments eventually. But, for example, you still see, there's still modernists. People who look at the abortion issue, for example, and say, well, but notice, this way we don't have to worry about all these unwanted children. Notice that all that this is going to save and the welfare rolls. Okay, now it's reducing it to utilitarian. To tangible things like money. Listen to the euthanasia debate. A modernist will say, well, yeah, we should have euthanasia to kill sick people because notice that will lower our health care costs in this country. You heard that? Again, that's a utilitarian approach to ethics. That's a modernist type of ethic. In religion, it's interesting, many people said that religion would die out in the 20th century. Theologians mostly were saying this. The modernist theologians, people like Bultmann, said that modern man cannot believe in miracles anymore because modern man is scientific. And they can't believe in the supernatural. So a number of theologians tried to recast Christianity without any miraculous element, by leaving out the supernatural. Of course, turning Christianity into, you know, a utilitarian, helping promote social progress and helping one another. Again, leaving out the supernatural, attacking the Bible where it talks about miracles. Well, we know miracles can't happen, so these miracle accounts in the Bible, they must have been added later by another writer through the oral tradition. And you have a whole branch of scholarship tries to treat the Bible like any other text, but it's really not like any other text because they're purposely throwing out what doesn't fit their modernist worldview. Well, modernism failed. Christians had always said that it was going to fail. Okay, but it did. And the encouraging thing is that everyone is admitting that now. In the universities, in the art world, there's a wholesale reaction against that kind of modernism, which is a very good thing for Christians. Notice what happened. Probably the first modernist ideology was that of the French Revolution. In the French Revolution, they went to Notre Dame Cathedral and they tore out all of the Christian symbols and the Christian altars and everything Christian, and they crowned a woman who was symbolizing the goddess of reason. And goddess of reason was enthroned in the most beautiful church of Christendom. That sums up modernism in many ways. But of course, look what happened to the French Revolution. It soon became a reign of terror. A reign of terror. Massacres. One faction cutting off the head of another faction, and the one faction got into power, and then somebody cut their heads off. And then it ended up with tyranny, the tyranny of Napoleon. The Marxist experiment ended up in the most brutal, most oppressive regime probably ever known by human beings. Even in this country, the welfare state, the social engineering program, did they work? No. I mean, and the failure is so manifest that even now liberals are having to admit that those things just didn't, even by their own terms, even utilitarian, they didn't even work. And of course, the modernists were forgetting what has been said is the one Christian doctrine that can really be proven. You can prove this even in modernistic terms by empirical evidence, the doctrine of original sin. And human sin has a way of wrecking every attempt a human being just live for themselves and just build from their own minds and their own intellect. It's interesting now that we're at the end of this century, the popularity of a movie like Titanic. Notice in many ways the Titanic sums up modernism, doesn't it? The huge ship, technologically great, Even God alone can't sink this ship. Sailed right out and ran into an iceberg. Okay. We've been hitting icebergs ever since in the quest of our modern mentality. It's interesting that the year 2000 bug is almost a perfect, maybe providential judgment, possibly. I hope it's not as bad as everybody thinks it might be. But again, the irony, the trust in our technology, our dependence on technology, and that it could all go away in the year 2000, the next century underway. What a grand finale, what an appropriate finale for modernism. Well, again, it's good that modernism is over. It's an opportunity for Christians, I'm going to show you. Modernism is very hostile to Christianity. Now, what's happened, though, is there's a new ideology that's growing up that's also hostile to Christianity. It's a response to modernism, to the fall of modernism, that opens up a whole dimensions of challenges for Christians. And it's very important that you notice this shift in worldview so you can deal with it and sort it out. Essentially, in the 1960s, you'll also be studying that time, among other things, you had a whole, almost a generation, an era of protest, and then the era of free love, and the era of the flower power, and all of the rest. But coupled with the protests of the Vietnam War and protests of their parents' lifestyle, developed into a real attack on Western civilization, on that whole heritage that had grown up with, that many young people were saying, this has just given us the atomic bomb and napalm, and we're going to move into a new era. So they were reacting against modernism also. What happened is a lot of the people active in the 60s in the youth culture, you know, they were occupying the dean's offices and protesting their professors. They grew up, and a good number of them entered academia. So now they are the new professors and the new academic deans. And in almost every field, you see a critique of the past that really can be traced right back to some of the 60s ideas. Essentially, this postmodern approach, you can think of it like this. You see the narrowing of the whole concept of truth. Finally, the only thing that's true is what we can see empirically. But now, what if that comes into question? What many of the postmodernists are saying is that maybe we can do without the category of truth. Maybe there is no truth. Specifically, and this came through also the philosophy of existentialism. We studied Nietzsche, some others. The existentialists, a group of philosophers, really, with backgrounds in the 19th century and among the fascist thinkers, and certainly in World War II, gained great prominence and then later dominance, accepted the notion that life is meaningless, that there is no meaning in life. And they took that literally. Well, there's no God, then life has no meaning. Of course, if life has no meaning, well, there is no meaning. But, and here is where they turned hopeful. There's no objective meaning, but we can create our own meaning. We can make our lives, our personalized, meaningful by our own choices, by our acts of the will. We can create a life that's meaningful for us. Okay, you maybe chose Christianity. That's good for you. That gives your life meaning. That's fine. Doesn't have anything to do with me. Maybe I choose communism. That gives my life meaning. And what's true for you may not be true for me. Of course, that's what it does to Christianity too. It removes it from the realm of truth. It's no longer objectively true. Something's true for everybody, whether somebody knows about it or believes in it or not. It's real. It's true. But this kind of revolution in thinking really constitutes the postmodern idea. Truth is began to be seen by a lot of scholars today as a construction. Truth is not a discovery of something out there. Truth is a construction, something that we make or that our culture makes. Truth is a construction, and truth claims are subject to infinite interpretation. The most you can do is interpret something. You know, the Constitution, the Bible, any statement that of principle. It's not what it is, because you can never get it a totally objective meaning. All we have are our own interpretations. And we can determine our own interpretations through our own choices and through all the things that influence us, our culture and so on. So, the big tenet of postmodernism, the new way of thinking, is, first of all, truth is relative. A lot of dominance lately of the social sciences. The modernist era, the natural scientists were really dominating things. And the pre-modern theology was the queen of the sciences. In the modern era, the natural scientists, the chemist, the physicist, the engineer. Now, the social sciences seem to be the queen of the sciences. They have a lot of emphasis on culture. A major stream of postmodernism is cultural relativism. The idea that every culture has its own truth. And who are we to say that our culture's truth is any better than that of another culture? Even when it comes to science. Science is greatly under attack today. So we have our approach to science. We look at it objectively and we analyze and cut everything up and manipulate it to do what we want. Somebody in the Amazon rainforest, the tribes there, they look at nature in a different way. They see nature as being alive, as being something they work in harmony with. And who's to say that our view of science, our view of nature, is any better than theirs? In fact, we have pollution and all of the environmental problems and so on. They live in harmony in the rainforest. A lot of the multiculturalism is actually a critique of Western civilization. But again, what it hinges on is the idea that truth differs from culture to culture. Other postmodernists focus on individual relativism. Again, kind of the existentialist view that you have your reality, someone else has theirs. And that we choose what we want to believe according to what we like and what we want it to be. Reason is rejected. And even in the universities, even in the highly intellectual world, you see the critiques of reason itself. It's interesting. When I would talk to, get acquainted with somebody who's not a Christian, I would give him C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity. It just does a great job of just showing the reasonableness of the basic Christian beliefs. You know, the great statement, is Jesus who he said he is or not? And again, making that very clear, either he is who he said he is, or he's a liar, or he's a madman. Take your pick, Lewis says. It's so logical, so clear in his look at showing just that Christianity does make sense. I noticed the last person I gave that book to, she wasn't a Christian, so I gave her the book of C.S. Lewis. She said, after it, she said, well, all she could look at was Lewis's sexist language. Okay. Notice how he uses he instead of he or she. And I was really offended by that. Well, okay, but notice she totally missed the logic, missing the content, picking up on these multicultural kinds of issues, and totally being oblivious to the rational thought. Again, sometimes as Christian, we take a lot of effort to kind of show Christianity logic. But what the frustrating thing is today, people often don't care. They'll say, oh, well, that's good for you. I'm glad you believe that. That's really, I really like that. But I've chosen something else. And see, that's what's happened. That's the consequence. If truth is relative, notice there's no way you can even communicate to anybody. No way you can even have a discussion with anybody. And used to, there would be something that two people maybe would argue about, and you'd talk it through, and maybe one of you would agree, or maybe you'd still disagree. But there's a point to it. In the postmodern mind, everyone is entitled to their own beliefs. That way, though, it's almost impossible when somebody's thinking in those terms to have a frame of reference that you share or to get anyone to change. In fact, what happens when truth is relative to a postmodernist, if you disagree with somebody, they take it very personally. You notice that? They're hurt by it. Because you're not accepting them. Now, truth is simply a projection of the self. If you're saying somebody else is wrong, that's a personal attack. And that's how they take it. You'll hear this. You're trying to impose your beliefs on me. You heard that? This is the postmodernists say, a lot of them. Okay, culture determines truth. And then some people, kind of the post-Marxists, take this next step. They say, and culture is simply a matter of power. Whoever has power in the culture uses that to keep other people in their place. So truth claims are only a projection of power. Okay. This is where you get a lot of the victim idea, that the moral teaching about homosexuality, that's just an attempt by white males to oppress gay people or to oppress women or minority or whatever it is. It's an act of power. So when someone says you're trying to impose your beliefs on somebody else and you don't have the right to do that, that's what they're saying. They think that you're exercising power to oppress them. You know, just if you disagree with somebody on whether it's on abortion or Christianity or anything else. Persuasion, reason, they're all thrown out in the postmodern mind. Not only is truth relative, morality is relative. Morality is a construction of culture. And different cultures have different beliefs, so they say, and so there are different kinds of morality. There's a great discussion in the Chronicle of Higher Education. That's the newspaper that your professors all take. It's the big journal of higher education. And an English teacher wrote in talking about the differences in the way she what she's playing in her classes when she teaches the short story, The Lottery. You've read that? Shirley Jackson's Lottery. It's about this small town and they're all gathering and they're having a lottery, and you don't really know what's going on. And it turns out, it ends up they're committing human sacrifice. Whoever gets the lottery, they're the ones that get sacrificed, and everybody stones the poor, just like in the ancient pagan times. Well, she said, used to when she would teach that, the discussions would always be, oh, isn't this awful? Isn't this terrible? Notice how people are conforming to patterns, even when they're bad. Notice how people turn against their own family members as they throw those rocks. And isn't this, and that would be the way it would go. She says, now she's shocked. She teaches that in her college class, and hardly anybody objects. What she hears is the people say, well, but that's their culture. Human sacrifice? Well, that's their culture. Who are we to say that that's wrong? Yes, I disagree with it. I would never do that. But that's their culture. And it got going, some exchanges, some letters to the editor. Professor really upset about it. There was another professor was talking about teaching about Hitler. You think Hitler, that would be somebody we could agree on. It was is not a nice person. But even discussing Hitler, what the professor is getting the classes is, well, that's his culture. Yes, I don't think he should have done all those things and put all those people in the gas chamber. But that's because I'm from this culture. And who knows what's going on with that? Now notice, these professors were very upset and thought this was a very bad thing. The students today have no moral sensitivity. But I say, those students have learned exactly what they were taught. That's exactly what they're getting in all their multicultural classes, in the indoctrination classes that many colleges are making students go to. I say they learn their lesson well. Give them an A. Okay. But the problem comes in what is being taught. And the fact that what is being taught has consequences that many of these scholars and academics and people who are kind of playing with these ideas of relativism are totally blind to. And yet they can have horrific consequences. Notice morality is seen as relative. Facts don't matter. It's interesting that now that we have the AIDS epidemic, for example, you would think that even in modernist terms, that would be pretty good evidence that premarital sex and drug abuse, and especially homosexuality, are not good ideas. Okay, and look at the horrific consequences. How can you deny? People are dying everywhere. But notice in the postmodern approach to morality, facts don't matter. Approval of homosexuality has skyrocketed since the AIDS epidemic broke out. Again, in the postmodern mind, facts don't matter. What matters in morality is choice. Remember the idea, it's the will. It's what you use to construct what's meaningful for you. Notice people who believe in abortion, do they call themselves pro-abortionists? They call themselves pro-choice. Now that sums up postmodernist ethics. What makes an action right or wrong is whether or not there was a choice. If a woman chooses to have the baby, that's fine. That's good for her. That's right for her. If she chooses to have an abortion, that's fine. That's right for her. As long as there's a choice. If there isn't a choice, well, you would think then that would be something that's wrong. Although they don't get very upset about China and their forced abortion policies. You don't get very much of that from the pro-choice movement. But again, notice that approach to morality. It's not just in abortion. It's in everything. Look at the euthanasia debate. utilitarian, a modernist, is, you know, wrong enough in saying, well, we should kill sick people. By the way, that's what euthanasia is, right? In other words, it's killing old people or sick people. Okay, think of it clearly. Think concretely. Rather than hiding it in nice words. But killing sick people is right because it lowers the healthcare cost. That's the utilitarian. The postmodernist says euthanasia is right, or killing sick people is right, if the person chooses to die. If they choose to die, then it must be all right for them. So pressuring everyone to sign these documents that let doctors or their relatives kill them at some point. Again, it's the choice. And it doesn't matter what the choice is. See, there's no content to the choice. As long as there's a choice, then something is considered moral. Truth is relative. Morality is relative. What we're seeing now is the idea that the human being is relative. The human being is a construction. You, yourself, you are a construction. You're constructed by your culture, by your situation, by your choices above all. But because of that, you can remake yourself. The modernist psychologists talked a lot about identity. The postmodern psychologists are saying, we have lots of identities. We have lots of identities. You're a different person when you're with your friends and when you're with your parents and when you're at church. And as you grow up and you'll have different jobs and you'll have different beliefs and you're a different person. The healthy personality is someone who's always remaking themselves. There's a new book of postmodern psychology called The Protean Self. The Protean Self. Proteus was a god in Ulysses in Greek mythology who keeps changing. You grab hold of him, and he's changing. He's a lion, and he's a snake, and he's a tree, and he's a gust of wind. And the postmodernist psychologists are saying that should be the model. The old psychologists wanted to, get your life together, establish your identity, straighten out your identity, know who you are. The postmodernists are saying no. Release that, change, be flexible, change whatever situation you're in. Begin the very self. Starts to kind of come apart. In that book, The Protean Self, J. Robert Liston, who wrote it, says that mental illness is when you only have one identity, when you're consistent. A healthy personality has many identities. It's exactly the opposite of what the modernists taught. I mean, when you have many identities, that used to be called schizophrenia. But now that's lifted up as a model. But do you know what he calls that mental dysfunction he sees? He calls it fundamentalism. Okay. Fundamentalist. The fundamentalist is one who has a strong identity, and that's the definition of mental illness. Keep that in mind, though. It's kind of funny, except he has in mind Christians. Think what would happen if Christianity were to be defined as a mental illness. Okay, it could very well happen. In fact, used to homosexuality was considered a mental disorder. Now, it's not any longer. American Psychological Association changed that. But now, homophobia is talked about as a mental disorder. Homophobia, fear of opposition to homosexual beliefs and practices. Okay. Again, realize what we may be up against here. Now, what are the consequences?
Well, for one thing, tribalism. Every culture has its own truth. Groups of people will gather together and they have their own truth, but there's nothing to connect them. So the pattern of kind of fragmenting, maybe in little communities or subcultures. What does that mean for education? Well, if there's no truth, what is there to teach? There are things you can do in school. You can learn to get in touch with your feelings and share your values, and you can. There's a new approach. You know, the new approach to teaching mathematics. Mathematics, you'd think, would be a very objective kind of sphere. The new approach in math education is called constructivist math, where you're taught how to construct your own math rules. It's totally serious. This is true. The whole language, constructive spelling, constructive writing. There's no right or wrong. Yeah, so there are lots of things that can do in school, but you're not going to. What's going to be lost is teaching objective content. In other words, instead of teaching about history, about the great events of history, you're taught to do history, to kind of talk about your family tree and things like that. You're taught the processes, but not the content. Now, am I right? You notice this in some of your schools? Even Christian schools sometimes. Many Christian schools adopt the same educational theories as the non-Christian schools and just add on Bible classes, which is good, and that's a great advantage. But it's frustrating to see them buying into postmodern education, which is failing. It's just creating thousands of illiterate people who can't do anything but who are high school and even college graduates. What does postmodernism do to religion? Well, the postmodern religion isn't going to have trouble with miracles like the modernist religion. In fact, postmodern religion is very open to any kind of supernatural. It doesn't have to make sense. It can be UFO cults, which you're going to be studying too. It can be, you know, channeling. In a way, the New Age movement fits postmodern worldview much better. Because the New Age, drawing on the Eastern Hindu worldview, teaches that the self does create the reality. So the God within creates the visible world. And it's much more fitting within this worldview, and that we're going to see a great rise, I'm sure, in that. But even among Christians in churches, they won't have trouble with the miraculous or the supernatural. But notice there won't be much interest in doctrine, for example. The postmodern Christian doesn't want to worry about things that are true. Okay. More interested in a self kind of gratifying, experiential kind of experience. Experiential experience, an experiential kind of a faith. A lot of emphasis on what the individual believer wants. Notice how you talk to people today about Christianity. I suspect you're guilty of that. I find myself slipping into the same language. We say, you know, I really like that church. I really like it. Instead of, boy, that church really, I really believe what that church teaches. Okay. That church is really teaching me what I need to hear. Instead, I like it. And so often we make our most important commitments on the basis of what we like rather than what is true. Okay. A lot of people today don't like parts of Christianity. So they like about Jesus, and so they don't like hell. Who could like hell? But no, because they don't like it, they assume there is no such place. Okay. again, what I want to know is, if there is such a place, how can I avoid going there? But again, the way people even approach religious issues is not in terms of the objective truth claim one way or another, on a completely different kind of basis. Let me pause at this to bring it home. Now, you study postmodernism, it seems so esoteric. You know, how could all these academics with so much time on their hands, how could they believe these things? What's amazing, though, about it is the way these esoteric ideas have penetrated through our whole culture so quickly, including among people who don't know what existentialism is or don't have any of these backgrounds, and yet people think this way. Let me propose this. I found that Christians, I teach in a Christian college, my Christian students tend to think this way too. At least until I point out the problem. But let's try this. You know you're a postmodernist if. Okay. Here's your little test. You know you're a postmodernist if you can accept two contradictory worldviews at the same time. You can accept two contradictory worldviews at the same time. You have your Christian worldview here, but then when you're doing something else, you're working with another worldview. I see this all the time with my students. I actually am not a homiletics professor, I'm just an English teacher. And I in my classes, I had this. I had a student who wrote about one essay about creation, and then he wrote another essay about animal rights, saying, well, animals have rights because, you know, if humans have rights and human beings are animals too, how can we say that animals don't have rights? I had my work cut out for me. But what struck me was the difference with the earlier essay. Here you wrote about God creating the universe, and now you're saying the human beings are no different from animals. Yeah? Well, okay, so God created human beings and animals exactly the same. Wow. So that God really didn't create human beings in his own image, and when humans die, they rot in the ground just like animals die. Well, no. Oh, well, I believe that human beings are different than animals in the religious sense. Okay. He had his religious sense, but then his position on animal rights came from, you know, watching television or wherever it came. In my book, Postmodern Times, I talk about Christian students who has a strong view, believes in the inerrancy of Scripture, and also he believes in reincarnation. Okay. I was talking to a thing like this, and a pastor came up to me and said he actually had that come up in his youth group, and the student, strong, very active, but he believed in reincarnation. He thought, oh, that was cool to come back in another life. So he said, well, he better set him down, and he opened the book of Hebrews, and the book of Hebrews said, okay, notice, it is appointed for every man to die once, and then cometh the judgment. Okay? So, what does it say? It's appointed for every man to die once, and then comes, is anything about going back and doing that, then comes judgment. Right, so you can see that the Bible teaches that there really is no reincarnation. And the young man said, well, that's your interpretation. Again, how else could you interpret those? You could not believe it. I couldn't believe that. But again, but people don't think logically. So, let's run through this. You know you're a postmodernist if you determine your beliefs by what you like. Determine by what you like. brethren, finding what the Bible says about them, or trying to figure out if it's true. You just go by what you like. If you do, as Jeff Foxworthy said, you might be a postmodernist. If someone tries to convince you of something, you think they're trying to impose their beliefs on you. Okay, talked about that. If you get really personally attacked and think they're trying to impose themselves, you might be a postmodernist. And you know you're a postmodernist if you begin every essay with what I call the obligatory relativism. Now, this in my writing classes all the time. And these are Christians in my class, mostly. They'll begin every essay. Of course, there are many different possible ideas on this, and everybody is entitled to their own view. Then maybe they'll say their own view, maybe they won't. But almost every essay on every topic, an assignment they're writing comparing two essays. One showed a really strong family, a child growing up in a really strong, another, the family was totally chaotic and the child was totally messed up, and they were supposed to compare and contrast those essays. So many of the classes, they would say, well, of course, there are many different ways to raise a family, and who is to say which one is better? Even that clarity, they could not get away from their obligatory, the need they felt to salute the prevailing idol of relativism. Now, watch for this, and watch for it in yourself. Because just like Sarah said, we will all breathe in the relativism of the surrounding culture. Okay. Watch for that in yourself and sort it out and notice it. Now, there is another alternative, though, to the failure of modernism. We've gone from pre-modern to modern. That turned out to be a big disaster. What they're trying now is the postmodernist kind of ideologies and say we can do without truth of every kind. This is another way you can respond to the failures of modernism. What can you do? Pre-modern, modern, postmodern. If modernism has failed, what about going back to the pre-modern? Going back to the biblical worldview that gave us the civilization we have, and bringing that into the present. Not that we're going back to another time and place, you can't do that, but to bring the insights of the pre-modern, the insights about truth, about morality, about revelation. Bring those and apply those to our contemporary issues. That, I think, is what holds promise. That's what a lot of people are doing. That's the opportunity for Christians that many Christians are realizing. Because postmodernism is just going to come apart. It's already apart. That's its point. That everything is apart. Everything is deconstructed. And now we have the reconstructionists who are trying to put things together again. And in a way, that sums up the challenge for Christians. Again, some Christians are panicked about postmodernism. And a lot of Christians, of course, are following it, hook, line, and sinker. Okay, and that's a problem. And I'm going to be getting into some of these other issues later in my talk. But what an opportunity for Christians. You know, Christians said this would happen. Christians said if you don't have God, you're not going to have a basis for truth, and you're not going to have a basis for morality. Well, we've been proven right. And now, the challenge we have as Christians, as students, as leaders, as people who are going to be involved in all of the professions, to build on truth again, to put it back together. I mean, what an advantage that we have because of that worldview that God has given us. What an opportunity. Again, my other talks, I'm going to talk about the actual advantage that I think you have as Christian students, as Christians growing up in this time, the advantage that you're going to have that other people are just lost, very literally. And so I'll be talking about that in some of my other talks. So, thank you very much.